Good morning. Welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it's my pleasure to welcome you here this morning to this session of the Roundtable. I wanted to remind you of upcoming programs. Next week, we'll be talking about OCRA, the Onondaga County Resource Recovery Agency. As you know, it is having to reinvent itself in a way once its contract with the owner of the plant is up. So that will be very interesting. There are a lot of public policy and environmental issues, along with just what's going to happen to our blue bins. So that's next week. The following week, we'll be talking with Mayor Stephanie Miner. So it's a little bit earlier in the budget year than we usually talk to her. So, but I'm sure you will have a lot of questions for her. So that's the next 2 weeks. This morning, we are going international. And to introduce Dr. Charles Benjamin, today's guest speaker, it's my pleasure to introduce David Allen, one of our newer TMR members. David is the Fund Development and Community Relations person at
Meals on Wheels.
Thank you, Sandra. Good morning, everyone. Dr. Charles Benjamin has over 20 years of experience in international development with extensive experience in community development and natural resource management throughout the Middle East and Africa. He helped establish NEF's Appropriate Technology Training Center, which spearheaded rural development initiatives across southern Morocco. He also served in Morocco as a Fulbright Scholar and as a Peace Corps volunteer. He was a senior manager with the International Resources Group in Washington, D.C. He taught courses on international environmental issues and development at Williams College. He holds a Ph.D. in natural resources and environment from the University of Michigan, with a focus on decentralization and local institutional development in West Africa. He has been associated with the Near East Foundation since 1993. Ladies and gentlemen, the president of the Near East Foundation, Dr. Charles Benjamin.
Thanks very much. Thank you. Thanks very much. It's a real pleasure to be here. So I'd like to start by asking you to think about your associations in your mind with the Middle East and North Africa. If you follow the headlines, it's probably not a very nice way to start your Thursday morning. And the associations are probably not very good. War, extremism, intractable conflict. My message today and the message of my work really is that in spite of these headlines, there's really a lot of reason for hope in this very important part of the world. If you look on the ground, at the community level. A lot of what I find hopeful in my own experience is based in part on the work of the Near East Foundation. We work with the most marginalized, vulnerable, disadvantaged people in the region, those who struggle and risk being left behind by changes in the world and in the region. And we give them the tools and skills that they need to participate more fully in the social and economic development and advancement of their communities and their countries. 4 years ago, Near East Foundation and Syracuse University entered into an exciting strategic affiliation. It's the first of its kind between a university and an international development NGO. We moved here from New York City. We moved our headquarters onto the campus of Syracuse University. We'd been in New York City for 95 years. And since then, we've had dozens of faculty members, SU faculty members, and students who've brought their creativity and energy to bear on NEF's work here in Syracuse and in the seven countries where we have offices now. So to start, I actually there's a little bit of a technical issue here. I had a couple of videos to share some of the voices of the people we serve, but I will try to explain without without their voices and images. This is Kadi Tangara. He's a farmer in Mali. He's a longtime partner of the Near East Foundation. We've been working in northern Mali for 30 years to introduce new agricultural technologies. And with Kadi and members of his community, through very simple technologies, we've been able to increase their rice production from one ton per hectare, hectare is about a little over two acres, to 8 tons, an eightfold increase. Very simple technology. Mali, if you've been following the news, or if you follow the news, last year came under occupation first by Tuareg separatists who were trying to establish their own country, and then by Al-Qaeda-affiliated jihadists, extremists. Kadi and the members of his community and throughout northern Mali were forced to consume the seed that they used to plant their rice. They emptied out their assets, their agricultural infrastructure, and you can kind of see it in this image, an irrigation canal, their earth buns that he uses to farm his rice, fell into disrepair because of insecurity. They were unable to go to their fields for almost 2 years to maintain this infrastructure. Kadi and people like him in northern Mali were at risk of falling into what we call a poverty trap. They don't have the assets to invest to maintain their lifestyles, their livelihoods, much less move forward. So building on our relationship, the Near East Foundation, once the French military operation had driven out the jihadists, were able to mobilize quickly, within 3 months, help the members of the community. We were working in 50 communities in this case to rebuild their agricultural infrastructure. We've never given a handout. This is not, we share the responsibility. We provide things that are beyond the means of people in this in these communities. There's always a cost-sharing element to it. And what we like to think that we do is to try to help people unlock their potential and get them to a point where they are self-sufficient and prosper. The second case, this is Latifa Kasim. She is a young woman from one of the communities we work with in the Palestinian territories in the West Bank. Latifa is part of a project that we started a year ago to help 200 young women start businesses over the next 4 years. In fact, this work is supported by, and you can't really see the logo there, it's supported by the Family Foundation of an SU alumnus named Tarek Rangoonwala. So we work very much in partnership with other foundations. And in this case, with a modest grant, we have been able so far to help about 100 women start businesses. We start with business training and a $300 grant. In Latifa's case, and if you have a chance to visit our website, the video is up there, you can hear her tell her story, how she faced enormous social pressure not to participate in the formal economy. This is something that girls don't do, something that women don't do. And she overcame some very significant barriers to start her business. In this case, she noted that in her community, the women were traveling to other places to buy their spices, and so she decided that she was going to start a spice shop. Through the business training, she identified this niche, understood her market, and started a sustainable business. She's supporting herself and gaining self-esteem. It's quite poignant, the words that she shares in this short video. It's two minutes, so, or 3 minutes maybe. What we're doing now is really on the same arc as where we started almost 100 years ago, 99 years ago, during one of the darkest moments of the 20th century. And the story of NEF is really the story of the birth of American humanitarianism abroad and of philanthropy as we know it today. It began with a call from Ambassador Henry Morgenthau, ambassador to the Ottoman Empire, to President Woodrow Wilson, who reached out to his Princeton roommate, Cleveland Dodge, who was in New York City. In 1915, they set out to raise $100,000 to provide refuge to Armenians, Assyrians, and other religious minorities who were displaced during the breakup of the Ottoman Empire and World War I. What they achieved really changed the course of history. It's an amazing story. In a 15-year nationwide campaign, a relief effort, which was unprecedented at the time. Think of all of the events that were organized to provide relief to Haiti after the earthquake there. They sustained this for 15 years. They raised $120 million, over $2 billion in today's dollars. they cared for more than 140,000 orphans and saved over 1 million lives. In the U.S., there were chapters in every major American city, the Near East Relief, as it was then known, including here in Syracuse. SU Chancellor Roscoe Day, I think in 1919, established a chapter in Syracuse University, in addition to a refugee education program to help resettle refugees from the Ottoman Empire here in Syracuse. Overseas, they established orphanages, food distribution centers, vocational schools, and hospitals. This outpouring became known as citizen philanthropy, involving average people in supporting humanitarian action abroad. It's a form of philanthropy that's very common today around the world. And here we have a remarkable picture from our archives of children at one of the orphanages, the Near East Relief orphanages in Armenia. And I was in Armenia last year. This particular orphanage still functions today as an orphanage. It's pretty remarkable. In the years since then, NEF's reliefs to promote self-reliance, beginning with the orphans and then members of their communities, created a model for social and economic development that is also now a centerpiece of both our foreign policy and our philanthropy. The Near East Foundation, as it became known in 1930, was cited as a model for the Marshall Plan, the Truman's Point Four program, which eventually became the U.S. Agency for International Development, the United Nations Development Program, and the U.S. Peace Corps. So it's really a great American story of how we came together with compassion as a society in a time of great need. And we're right here in Syracuse. It's a phenomenal story. Today, we find ourselves in another historic moment of great importance. As one of our board members described this, a former ambassador to Syria, a tectonic shift in the social and economic landscape of the Middle East and North Africa. In my travels through the region recently, I've been struck that this is in spite of all the negative news that we hear about war in Syria, about conflict, post-revolution conflict in Egypt, the tumult of the region, I've actually been struck that the aspirations, the commitment, and the effort to bring about positive change are actually stronger than ever among the communities where we serve. If you look beyond the national level and get down to the community level, people are so hopeful right now for change. We work with them in partnership with Syracuse University, with local organizations in the field, and with other organizations to find sustainable ways to help them overcome some of their greatest challenges: poverty, food security, a voice in public decision making, and solutions to persistent conflict. Our teams in the field are promoting economic development, cooperation, and peace building in areas like Darfur and in northern Mali. In the West Bank, where this photograph is from, we started 2 years ago a program to build cross-border economic cooperation between Israelis and Palestinians. when we started, it was pretty remarkable. We were not dissuaded, but people greeted this idea with incredulous, to say the least. We have been working in 34 communities in northern Israel and in the northern West Bank to improve the flow of information, of goods, and of technology across the Palestine-Israel border, reducing production costs in the olive sector, improving the quality of olive oil, supporting joint marketing, and ultimately increasing profits to farmers. What we're trying to do is to get people to work together to improve their own lives by improving the sector as a whole, and they can only do this by finding their mutual interests and understanding the economic reasons for working together. And what we found, what I found, and I'm not a business person, but the language of reconciliation, peace building, trust, communication, open flow of information, is the same as I understand the language of doing good business. So by the second year of the project, we had organized 355 major events, 30 cross-border events bringing together Palestinians and large numbers of Palestinians and Israelis. We have more than 1,300 participants in this project. And last year, through these grassroots efforts, we helped broker an agreement between the Palestinian Authority and the Israeli government to open the border. This is a trade agreement to open the border to the olive oil trade for the first time in 12 years. It had been closed since the beginning of the Second Intifada. Within 2 months, that agreement had resulted in, it had brought $4.5 million of new income to our Palestinian partners, and an additional 10% on top of that to the intermediaries that we work with in both Palestine and Israel. What we're trying to do is create, through economic development, lasting incentives for people to work together, and trying to create a virtuous spiral of economic growth and increased trust that will ultimately have create a groundswell, I guess, of demand for peace. And the incentive will come from people's sense of well-being of their families and their communities. So that was the $4.5 million was the result of 900 tons of olive oil crossing the border from Palestine to the West Bank to Israel. I heard informally that last year the total figure of this was 3,200 tons of olive oil traded. This is olive oil that would not have made it to market otherwise, worth $16 million. If you consider the cost of this project over 3 years is $1.2 million, is a pretty good return on investment from an economic sense and from a peace dividend sense. I'm going to skip this photo. This is actually one of our farmer field schools in the West Bank, where we teach very simple new techniques that increase profitability of olive farming by 168%, we found. That's net. But we wanted to understand what the impact of this activity was on reconciliation, peace. So we asked a Syracuse University PhD student, who's actually with us now in the West Bank, to help us understand this. And she conducted a survey at the midway point of the project. What she found was really astounding, probably even more than the income from this. She found that 94% of the participants in the project reported positive interactions with people from the other side. 96% found cross-border economic cooperation beneficial to them personally. 90% felt that they had developed increased trust. This is all self-reporting, but encouraging nonetheless. 94% thought that cooperation and norms of trust could eventually be generalized throughout their communities. And now we have just launched another cross-border effort, and this work is funded by the U.S. Agency for International Development. Another cross-border effort, three-year project, to help young people in particular start cross-border joint ventures. So we've actually established a small investment fund providing training and creating opportunities for Palestinian and Israeli young people to work together, and then providing them small grants to start their businesses with I think in this case a 50% cost share. So and when we're focusing again on agriculture because it involves so many people. In some cases, and this is a photograph from Mali, we're helping people recover from conflict. And I mentioned in Mali we've been working for 30 years, one of the poorest regions of the on the planet, actually, helping people learn new techniques and to improve agricultural productivity, the sustainability of their environment, and to prosper in spite of the challenges that they're faced with. Post-conflict, and this is starting last year, we were able to help these people we've been working with for so long who were dealt such a blow by the occupation recover by helping them to rebuild their agricultural infrastructure, like this livestock well right here that we worked with one community to repair after it had experienced a threefold increase in the number of people and animals using it as people were displaced from further north in Mali. We also organized seed and tool fairs using a voucher system to help people recover their lost assets, the things that they needed to produce food and income for themselves. We tried to mimic the market. We engaged local vendors. We distributed, actually sold vouchers, so there was a cost-sharing aspect of this, so people paid a quarter of the price of the vouchers and then were able to use the vouchers with local merchants to buy seed. And what we saw this as jump-starting people's return to self-sufficiency. In addition to this, we also provided 2,000 women with small grants to restart their businesses. And we're doing the research right now to figure out how many of these businesses have now achieved self-sustainability. But what we have noticed through a lot of these women entrepreneurs had been clients of our microfinance bank that we established in Mali. During conflict, and during occupation, this is quite remarkable to me, women continued to reimburse their small loans in spite of the occupation and insecurity until things got really bad. And then reimbursements dropped from 96% to 98% to 71%. What we've seen since these grants were made, and we also accompanied it with training and business management and asset accumulation, that the reimbursement rate of these loans has increased to 91%. In other areas of the world, this is from Morocco, this is work unrelated to conflict. We are simply helping people to confront their most pressing challenges and again to achieve self-sufficiency. In Morocco, we have worked with, we just finished a three-year project working with 22 communities in eastern Morocco, a very arid region, one of the most arid regions of Morocco and North Africa outside of the desert, through training and support to help introduce commercially oriented agriculture, such as using new crops and new production techniques, and to increase water use efficiency. We, through this project, helped 5,000 farm families, through very simple, accessible means, increase their income by 25% while decreasing their water use by 50 to 60%. Some of this was achieved by field-level crop and water management. Others, some of it was achieved through what we called community micro projects. And these range from the restoration of ancient canals, tapping into aquifers, and creating underground rivers, essentially, to irrigate fields. And this is a shot of an underground canal, an underground part, and then a part where it emerges, and then is then used to irrigate fields. In this case, the canal had not produced water in 7 years. There were structural problems inside of it, and it had not withstood a flood. So we helped introduce structural changes to this, and very small, simple engineering techniques. You can actually see them here on the photograph in the left. You know, using a little bit of concrete, putting in a concrete ceiling so that there was less of a likelihood of collapse. At the other end of the spectrum, we also introduced solar-powered pumping for vegetable production, which was quite profitable for the area, in this case using drip irrigation. Across the region, we are also working with vulnerable women to help empower them to start businesses, access microcredit, and create support networks so that they can meet the needs of their families, achieve economic security, and contribute to the development of their communities. This is a photograph from Jordan, where we're working with Iraqi refugees and women in their host communities to help them, again, set up small businesses through business training, business management training, business planning, access to microcredit, and in these cases, sharing with them the cost of business startup through small startup grants. We see this as a way of helping them not only overcome their deep poverty, but of also addressing the issue of social exclusion and the isolation that refugees face in their urban context. They're not living in camps, they're living in communities. To me, this is an exciting project for a few reasons. First, because of its impact, but also because it's the first time that the government of Jordan, which has received so many refugees for so long, Palestinians, Iraqis, Syrians, I've heard the figure, I don't know where it stands at this point, but a few years ago, 70% of the population in Jordan had their origins as refugees. But this is the first time that the government of Jordan has given approval to help refugees start businesses to achieve self-sufficiency. I see this is a landmark. It's being recognized as a landmark decision by the United Nations system, by the U.S. government, and so on. This is work actually funded by the U.S. government through the Population, Refugees, and Migration Program. But I see this as a sign of confidence in the organization, the Near East Foundation, which has been a consistent partner for development in Jordan since 1938, without interruption. Now, you know, across the region, women face significant social barriers, and we have programs in 5 countries now to support women's business development. Our focus really is on the most vulnerable among the women who are, you know, arguably among the most vulnerable people in this region to start with. But we're talking about female heads of household, widows, and survivors of domestic violence. We are trying to use the tools of economic development to address broader social issues. In Armenia, where this photograph is from, we are working with 2 women's shelters to help survivors of domestic violence, again, start small businesses and establish support networks so that they are able to break free from their abusive environments. At these women's shelters, before this program, we were told that without exception, the women who seek refuge there are compelled to go back to their abusive environments because they have no economic independence. They have no means of earning a living. And this is due, partially to social norms in Armenia that shape what expectations are for men and women, and also what's acceptable behavior of men towards women, and you know, the dialogue, the argument, the debate around domestic violence is heated right now in Armenia. It's a big problem. And so this is in a country, in a region where women have very little economic freedom or security. Finally, in Morocco and Egypt, and this is probably the work that that is most closely linked to what we have heard referred to as the Arab Spring, we are working with young people to develop a new generation of civic leaders. We're helping young leaders learn community organizing skills, to find their own solutions to the problems that they identify, and unemployment is without exception the major issue that they're preoccupied with, and undertake community improvement projects. This takes a variety of forms. Between Egypt and Morocco, we've worked with thousands of young people in the past 2 to 3 years. The thing that I keep thinking about in this, when we look at the effort that these young people are making to build just, democratic, fair community, this is all going on under the radar of what we hear in the news. But it strikes me that in some ways it's easier to take down a tyrant than to build up a democratic society in its place. And what we are doing with these young people, I think of this in terms of giving them the skills for constructive engagement. How do you work with your government so you can articulate your needs and aspirations and take action that results in positive change? And this is where we are now. And the dynamic and the results are quite exciting. So what I hope that you would take away from this brief presentation is that in spite of the complicated politics, complicated relationship between the Middle East and our country, in spite of the violence that we hear about in the news and that makes headlines, there's really a lot to be hopeful for at the grassroots. And the people who are experiencing this tumult are hopeful and making efforts for positive change. Modest investments can have an enormous, even transformative impact on individuals, on communities, and ultimately on countries. In the tumult, there is great opportunity. There's also great opportunity for positive change and for people like us to have a positive and lasting impact. So thank you, and I'd be happy to take questions.
Question over here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I had a question that goes to government and how the impact on everything you're doing. You deal with the indigenous, with the locals, in terms of helping them to develop themselves, I guess, into something. I've had some exposure to working with Egypt, Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, but in each case, it was for trying to do business with those countries, mm-hmm. and particularly for foreigners. But whenever there's involvement with government in terms of needing contracts approved or permits or whatever, you cannot do it by a foreign person. You have to have a local that's initiating it. And you also have to become part of their culture, which for us we call graft over here. But you got to take care of everybody in government. How does that play into what you're trying to achieve as you get the people that are there, locals, to get those permits and do all those things that they got to do with their own governments?
Right. That's a great question. And, you know, we work with government wherever we are. Sometimes government is more receptive to the type of work we do, and sometimes they're less receptive. One of the distinguishing features, characteristics of our organization is that all of our overseas staff are from the countries where they work. And they've been with us for a long time, and we've been in these countries in most cases for a long time. They design our projects. Our project in the West Bank in Israel was designed by our Palestinian staff. I would never have thought to get involved in this type of an issue. We do economic development. We work with the poor. They have a sense of what the opportunities are and what the right way of approaching things are and what the limits of what we can do. Jordan was a very sensitive case because, you know, we
we have experienced the resistance of the government and understood their position on why they didn't want to help refugees stay, honestly. They wanted them to take refuge and then go back to their homes when the time was right. And in this case, you know, these were relationships, and there's no graft. We don't do any of that. We understand it's a very complicated bureaucratic environment that we operate in, and I think that the intuition and cultural skills to navigate these systems really comes from our local leadership. Some of our local leaders, we call them country directors, country coordinators, have been with us for 25 years. And there's a long-term commitment to the organization, and we have a long-term commitment to these countries and these communities. So,
you mentioned that you started some women in 2000 businesses. What does one of them look like? What's the scope of them, or what are they?
That's a good question. I would say that most of them are in small-scale trade, so and sometimes in manufacturing. So trade would be, you know, buying agricultural products from places of abundance and reselling them in places where they don't have any. We have one woman who I learned about during, because she was, it was related to the credit repayment issue, who is making charcoal and selling charcoal in local markets. There's spice shops, there is food processing, making local you know, bakeries, things like that. There's one case in the West Bank that I think is exciting, but we have a group of women who are actually working in cut stone, which is a traditionally a men's business, but a small group of them have broken into this. So the small scale manufacturing, food processing, retail, Latifa's spice shop, things like that.
Just following up on the question about the relationship with the local governments, I think these are just remarkable stories. I mean, just incredible.
Thank you.
Incredible success and doing so many positive things. I wonder, has this had any effect on U.S. policy or initiatives or direction, or what's the relationship with our own government?
It's great. It's a great question, and I'm thinking of this because our olive oil project, what we've been told, and this project has been, it's a small project in the scope of what the U.S. government does, and even in the West Bank, what USAID funds, but it has gotten, because what we've been told, that this has provided proof of concept that track two diplomacy can work. We receive senior officials from the U.S. government on a regular basis in our project, from the State Department, from USAID, and in fact, we are preparing a shipment of 120 bottles of our olive oil, our signature olive oil without borders, to send to members of the U.S. Senate right now, at the request of the State Department. So, in Darfur, this is another case where I think, you know, you get a good idea going at the grassroots and communicate it in the right way, it can gain traction. In Darfur, we are working in areas of, you know, that are perceived as being, you know, dealing with intractable conflict, intertribal warfare, and so on. We started a process 2 years ago to bring groups in conflict together to work out collaborative land use management plans, shared resources, pasture, water resources, forests, things that they depend on for their livelihood. We had a professor from Syracuse University go and provide training to the government and to our local partners in conflict management and peace building reconciliation, equipping them with tools to take that experience and turn it into something bigger. And that's something that this is funded by the United Nations Development Program, but this is providing them with a model of what can work, and it's actually shaped. There was a subsequent round of funding for this through this mechanism, and they based their entire request for proposal program design on this experience. So I would say that we are hopeful that we can at our grassroots level create and communicate models that will provide concrete alternatives to the status quo.
Thank you. And your last answer to Mitch's question kind of gets to my question, which was more specifically, how do you work with other aid organizations? From you mentioned UN, World Bank, mm-hmm. USAID, but there's also aid organizations of other countries and other NGOs.
That's
there.
Right.
It seems like you're in a powerful position because of having so much time there that you can really leverage aid from various organizations and serve as an arbiter or an ombudsman to help solve problems even in addition to partnering to get things done. So maybe you could just talk some more, because what you've just explained is very fascinating. Thank you.
We do participate at the national level. In most of these cases, there are always several fora that bring together development actors to talk about their experience, to share the lessons, to synthesize information about what's going on the ground, and we participate. So we participate in as many of those as we can. I would say that the landscape that we're working in has changed very much. Even since I was the country director for the Near East Foundation in Morocco for 6 years in the early and mid 1990s. This was before we went with this idea of having all local staff. Since that time, there has been an emergence, really, of local development organizations. And what I've seen over the past 25 years is really a scaling down of our own operations so that we can provide leadership and actually work with and through local organizations to actually do the work. So in Darfur, we have two local NGO partners. For those of you who are not familiar with the acronym NGO, non-governmental organization, development organizations like the Near East Foundation. We have two partners who are actually the front line of what we do, and they will stay behind. You know, we may leave Darfur, but they'll stay behind. They're part of the fabric, the social fabric. In Morocco, the water project, we worked with two local organizations who are also the front line. We did project management, project design, capacity building of these groups. In Jordan, it's a complicated landscape, but we work with four community-based organizations, so community-based NGOs, who are actually working directly with the Iraqi refugees and members of their host community. We coordinate with the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, United Nations Population Fund, the U.S. State Department, and help them understand what's going on at the local level. I think, you know, for our government, if you look at their presence overseas, I've been highly impressed through our experience. But they value input from organizations like the Near East Foundation to understand what's going on in the ground, and they trust us to assess the situation and to take action that will have, you know, the kind of impact that we all hope, and in the case of Jordan, self-sufficiency.
Hi, one of the, you know, I think your olive oil project hits on one of the horror stories that you see around the Palestinians, that with the wall, with settlements, with settlers, you know, if you look at all, you just see destruction of this valuable asset that the Palestinians have. Have you dealt at all with olive oil growers, Palestinian olive oil growers that have endured that kind of destruction of their assets? And have they, what's been their reaction, I guess, with this project?
Yes, we have. And it's hard to, for those of you who have visited the West Bank, you have seen for yourself that it's hard to go anywhere without seeing a settlement. I think that, and the Palestinians who we work with have experienced, you know, destruction of olive trees. They experience on a daily basis barriers to their free movement through checkpoints. Which which makes it more, all the more impressive that they're still optimistic. And they are. The people who we work with, and I won't say that this is something that you can generalize across all of the Palestinian population, but you know, the people we work with are optimistic. They have a great desire to change the way things are, and they see not only are they can differentiate between settlers and the rest of the Israeli population, and they can also have a good understanding that not all Israelis are the same, and that there are people who want peace and there are people who don't want peace. They don't want it. They don't want coexistence. And you know, I think that they understand that where their opportunity lies is to build these relationships with the people who are open to this type of a relationship and change in relationship. Where I see one of the bigger issues in this cross-border aspect is that you know Palestinians live on a daily basis with the presence of Israel in one way or another. And my experience in the West Bank is much deeper than my experience in Israel. So I don't say this with complete confidence, but in my experience, it's possible to be a citizen of Israel without having any interaction with a Palestinian. And I've had people tell me this. I've had people tell me this who are responsible for grant making, foundation grant making to build peace between Palestinians and Israel. In their daily life, they don't interact with Palestinians or even Arabs, really. So you know, there's great diversity in this area. As a foreigner, I don't think I have the answers, but I trust that the people who we're working with and our leadership on the ground does know where to start and how to bring this about. And that you know, the results of this project have exceeded everybody's expectations, our own expectations included, and it's been so encouraging.
Encouraging, I'd like the word. It's wonderful hearing encouraging kind of news. My question is completely different in the sense you talked about building these different models that might impress higher ups or the government. Do you think it's transferable to the poor in this country? Do you think any of your models can be translated to our culture and deal with deep poverty and the philosophy of the government to change that?
Yes. I actually, you know, I wouldn't say I get asked this question regularly, but you know, periodically people will say, boy, we have so many problems here in the U.S. Why are you working in the Middle East? And I look around, particularly in parts of Syracuse, where I think that the types of things that we do could have a great impact. I mean, small business creation, entrepreneurship, microcredit even. Pairing small business development with reconciliation work, and you know, we're looking at, for example, here in Syracuse, the relationship between the refugee population and their host community, I think, is something that from what I understand, is something that needs to be addressed. And I totally think that the types of approaches that we're piloting are applicable here. You know, we are to call us a foundation is a little bit of a misnomer. we depend on contributions, on grants from foundations, from governments, U.S. government, foreign governments, to do our work. And so we have to be aware of what our limitations are. But certainly, you know, I think I would welcome the opportunity to work with local organizations here in Syracuse to try out some of these things. So if any of you all know of any opportunities, I'd welcome the chance to discuss.
Okay, be prepared.
You're all right.
Hear from us.
Understanding that we are resource constrained, both in terms of people and people mostly.
I don't see any way that we personally, or I personally, could help besides maybe buying olive oil. If you have a product and you don't sell it, it's not of much value. I don't know, you go to Wegmans and there's a whole row of olive oils you can buy. Can you assist us in something like that?
Yeah, well, this is actually something we're trying to figure out. In fact, yesterday I was dealing I was reviewing the labels for our olive oil. And, you know, we're not trying to start a company, but we have been encouraged to work with our partners to develop some type of a joint venture that would actually get some of this olive oil that's, you know, combined Palestinian-Israeli olive oil into the market under this Olive Oil Without Borders. So I'll let you know. But I agree, that's the kind of thing, you know, if we're trying to create economic incentives to get people to work together, find their mutual interests and create incentives for long-lasting relationships, the economics of it have to be viable.
Yeah. Good morning. The only thing that I heard that you specifically have learned in 100 years is to use homegrown people. So my question is, can you now use homegrown people because other projects have worked and education has increased in these countries? Or how have the people in their native countries developed so you can use them to run the projects?
Right. Things have changed. And, you know, this region is one where there's such great potential of people. I mean, the people are amazing. And I see one of the biggest challenges actually of this region is the disparity between people who are educated and have resources and people who are being left behind. This is what I'm saying. What I think of our work in terms of helping these people who are marginalized, disadvantaged, and helping them participate in the development of their communities and their countries. And when I say participate, I mean benefit from and contribute to. And in some ways, what we're doing, I guess you could think of it in this way, is getting through local leadership, having them reach out to marginalized populations in their own country to bring them into the mainstream. Because there's a lot of positive change. If you go to Morocco, for example, and I imagine there are a number of folks here who have been to Morocco, you will arrive in a city that looks like a European city. If you go 2 hours outside of that city, actually even a half an hour outside of that city, you will find people who are living like they do in sub-Saharan Africa. There are valleys in Morocco where people are born, live, and die without leaving their valley, particularly women who don't have as much mobility as men, but sometimes men as well. So, yeah, I think that, you know, there's just such great capacity locally. And it's due to an accumulation of change over a lot of times. I wouldn't want to speculate what has created that capacity, but it's a lot of things. But it's definitely a great potential there that needs to be tapped into.
Well, thanks for your stories this morning. I find they're really inspirational, and the results just sound fantastic. But when I hear stories like this, one of my reactions is that every one of them, perhaps with possible exceptions, is an indictment of government, of local governance. And I guess I'm piggybacking on Ed's first question. I'm going to put a little more pressure on you because,
okay. All right.
Because these countries have been independent. They've been self-governing for at least half a century, sometimes longer than that. If a foundation like yours came to America and started, we asked about doing things here. Our government, people here complain about big government getting into everything. There are hundreds of initiatives by government to help poor people. They're not all working. Maybe none of them have worked. But we're still trying as a government to get it right. The malfeasance, the corruption, the inadequacy, the complete failure of good governance, the lack, the insufficiency of governance in these countries leads to my two questions. One, doesn't your presence there represent a kind of intervention that would make government officials sensitive to kind of a neocolonial, you know, we can come in and run your country for you better than you can, but because you're not there, you're absent. And secondly, is there any sign that you're talking about building government from the grassroots, but is there any sign that this, I mean, this is not a natural disaster. These are people governing people. Mm-hmm. How could they not be taking care of the needs of their own people?
Mm-hmm. So are we, in fact, by our presence, perpetuating this system, letting them off the hook? You know, that's a complicated question. I'm sure I don't need to tell you that. We recognize that in many of the situations where we work, that governments are not functioning as well as they should. And I don't want to speculate on in the situations where we work on corruption and things. I've seen a lot of positive change. And I guess one of the things that I see is a type of work that we do, it's not a solution, right? It is part of a bigger solution. I'm of the scattershot school. Let's do a lot of stuff. Let's see what it adds up to. What we're doing makes sense at a local level. Government is not static in these areas. And what I've seen is that. In Mali, for example, you know, Mali was, I think, in 1960 became an independent country, 1968, 1960. In the early 90s, they experienced a coup, popular discontent with an autocratic ruler. This ushered in a period of democracy, democratization. It's not something that people really had a lot of experience with, either rulers, those who governed and those who were governed. We actually worked with local government to help them get skills to learn how to govern, how to put together a municipal budget, how to prioritize investments, how to create fora so that citizens could participate in public decision making. And it has had an impact. It's, you know, it's rife with politics, and I don't think that people have worked out exactly how to deal with these politics. They get nasty sometimes, you know. But what I've seen over the past 20 years in a place like Mali is that you've got, you know, political culture is changing. And political culture, these are ideas, you know, that people have about, you know, who's got a right to rule them. What can they expect from their leaders? How can they hold their leaders accountable? And I think that you know, on all sides, from, you know, those who are in power to those who are subjects in some cases or citizens in other cases, that it's a long-term process of changing the way that they think about government and what they want from government. I don't think that being in a place and doing work that's in parallel to the government or independent from government, I don't think that we necessarily need to think of that in terms of, you know, are we letting the government off the hook or not? You know, any more than here, there are all kinds of civic groups in the U.S. as well. So government does some things. Meals on Wheels does things. You know, government, there's a relationship between civil society organizations and government agencies. So we'll see. I see it as a long-term process. I mean, you talk about governments being corrupt. Well, there, you know, in a lot of cases, you're talking about countries that were created by Europeans that bring together people who have, you know, no interest in being part of the same country. And what's a country anyway? I'm, you know, of this family or this tribe or, you know, what. And so we're in the position not only of building up a system of good governance, but of, you know, creating a national identity where identity is created by many, many different from many, many different sources. So. It's, you know, I know that the governments in some cases where we're working are not acting in the interests of their constituents, but they're not going to be until there is pressure to do that. And that pressure is not going to come unless there are, in my mind, deliberate efforts to change the way that people think about government, what they should expect from them, and you know, how they hold them accountable. I don't know if that answers your question.
That was very well said. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Charles Benjamin, and thank you, Near East Foundation.